Live from the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man with your host, Hank Hanegraaff. The Bible Answer Man is on the air because truth matters. To get on today's program, call 888-ASK-HANK. That's 888-275-4265. And now, here's the host of the Bible Answer Man, Hank Hanegraaff.
Thank you very much, Randy. Before we go to our callers, just a word about the Creation Answer Book, now available for your gift to the ongoing work of the Christian Research Institute. And do remember, for your gift of $100 or more, we'll send you a personalized copy to you, a family member, or a friend, or when you join the monthly Bible Answer Man support team. And we need many of you to do that this month in particular. I'll send you a personalized copy of the Creation Answer Book. And do remember that this is not just a apologetic issue, this is the apologetic issue. How one views their origins inevitably determines how they live their life. If you believe that you're a function of random chance, you're going to live your life by a significantly different perspective than if you know that you are created in the image of God and accountable to Him. Again, the Creation Answer Book, answers to the most common and controversial questions about creation, available for your gift all this month. And in order to have your question answered today, remember the number to dial, 888-ASK-HANK, translates to 888-275-4265. We'll go right to the callers. First up is Scott, listening in Olive Branch, Mississippi. WCRV. Hi, Scott.
Hello. Do you hear me?
I sure can.
Okay. Just making sure. Hank, my question concerning the NIV translation, you know, the one that I've been reading for years now, just for an example, like in Romans 4:4, says, now when a man works, his wages are not credited to him as a gift, but as an obligation. Where now it says, now to the one who works. And I think, like in Luke 17, it says, if a brother or sister sins against you, are they being faithful to the text by changing man to one, or are they being politically correct on that? That's basically my question. Is that appropriate?
Yeah, well, that's the linguistic debate. Can you take generic masculine words and interchange for those generic masculine words gender-accurate words? And I would say the answer to that question is yes. For example, not only the particular instance that you cite, but passages like Revelation chapter 3, him and he replaced by they and them.
Okay.
So given the state of the English language, do the words he and him have a generic application? And I would say the answer to that question is yes, they do. So on the one hand, you have a grammatical issue. On the other hand, there is a theological debate, and that is, were the generic masculine words intended to convey the theological concept of male headship? And that's a significant theological debate. And I think what's important to recognize in the debate is that there are applications that require a masculine. And the reason for that is God has taught us how to think about Himself, how to speak about Himself, and we should not tamper with that. But in the cases that we just cited, the one you cited, the one I cited, I think it's fairly clear that the idea in view is not just an idea that applies to males. It applies to both males and females. And therefore, I don't think this has anything to do with being politically correct. I think it has to do with being accurate in terms of what the translation from one language to the other includes. And if it is inclusive of male and females, then it should be rendered as such. And by the way, there's an article that we did in the Christian Research Journal in which there's a debate on this. So you have people on various sides of the issue debating it. It's called the Inclusive Language Debate, and you can go to the World Wide Web at equip.org and see that debate.
One other thing I would like to ask you real quick. This is my first time to ever call on the show, so I listen to you regularly. I appreciate the response you've made to Bart Erdman.
Yes.
I really do. I think it's very needful. And my question about people like Bart Erdman that say, you know, the Bible has been so poorly edited, copied and edited that we lost the original meaning and we can't know the meaning at all. Wouldn't that be a departure from historic Christian doctrine? And if so, does that mean that he's a Christian or not a Christian when people take?
Oh, he doesn't consider himself a Christian.
Oh, he doesn't even consider himself.
Oh no,
a Christian.
not at all. He went to Wheaton and he went to Moody, but he doesn't consider himself to be a Christian in any sense anymore. He considers himself a happy agnostic. And,
okay.
And what he does is he overstates issues. For example, he will say something like, there are more mistakes in the manuscript copies than there are words in the New Testament. Well, does he have a point? Yes. There are literally thousands and thousands of mistakes. But what he does is he overinflates the value of those mistakes. They're minor mistakes. They don't impinge on any essential of the historic Christian faith. And beyond that, because there is a wealth of manuscript copies, you have a wealth of mistakes, but they're not all the same mistakes. So consider the fact that I write maybe a monograph on neo-terrorism. And once I handwrite that, I hand out that copy to you and five of your friends, and I say, please copy this for me because I want to make sure that I have a copy. This is in the days when there are no copy machines. So you do that. And then let's suppose, just to be sure, each of you asked five of their friends to do the same thing. Eventually, you'd have a wealth of copies, and every one of the copies would include some kind of a mistake. You might miss a conjunction, you might misspell a word, but you wouldn't all make the same mistakes. And therefore, with the wealth of manuscript copies, you're able to get back to the autograph. And that's what's called, by those who study texts, the tenacity of the text. Through the tenacity of the text, the autograph emerges without fail. So actually, the mistakes are not substantive, number one, and number two, because of the wealth of manuscript copies, we can get back to the autograph or the original. So he's overstating the case, but to the unlearned, they think, wow, we've got a real problem here. We can't trust the Bibles that we have, and nothing could be farther from the truth.
Okay. Well, thank you, Hank. Appreciate your time.
You got it, Scott. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go back to the phone lines, talk to Lorenzo in New York, New York. Hi, Lorenzo.
How are you, Hank?
Good, thank you.
I'm glad to hear that. I have a simple question, something that's been gnawing at me, as it were. Can you please direct me to a verse within the Old Testament that bespeaks that the Jews were to kill their own Messiah in order to have messianic prophecy fulfilled?
Well, the whole idea of messianic prophecy is in the Old Testament, you have a portrait that is given of Messiah. Jesus Christ emerges in the New Testament fulfilling all the description given in the Old Testament, from his ancestry to his birth to the circumstances surrounding his death, to the date of his visitation, to the fact that he would be an extraordinary worker of miracles, and that he was not only called to be Messiah to the Jews, but also to the Gentiles. So the portrait is a composite portrait, and therefore we would not point to one aspect of the portrait, but we would say this is a composite picture. And that picture can only be fulfilled by one person. For example, if you say that the birthplace has to be Bethlehem, and not just any Bethlehem, but Bethlehem Ephratah, out of all the towns and hamlets in the world, there is now only one place in which Messiah can be born. So you take that, not in isolation, but you take that as a composite piece of the whole. And a composite piece of the whole is that Messiah will, in fact, die. You find that, for example, outlined in the prophecies of Isaiah. So you have stars in the constellation of biblical prophecy in the Old Testament. You see the fulfillment of those clusters of stars in the New. But again, it takes a composite picture, and it also takes understanding typological prophecy, which is the idea that Jesus Christ is the antitype that fulfills the types and shadows in the Old Testament. So in some cases, the fulfillment is typological as opposed to being a specific messianic prophecy that has, for example, the birthplace delineated in a specific way.
Okay. I thank you for your time, Hank, but none of that answered my question. No matter what you say, no matter the beautiful manner in which you put it, somewhere within there has to be some type of verse that delineates that Messiah, whomever he would be, whether the Christian concept of Messiah or the Jewish concept of Messiah, must die and killed at the hands of his own people in order to have messianic prophecy. My second question would be this. Where does it state then, do you know historically, if you can help me, of any Messiah before and after Jesus who claimed to be Messiah, who was then also, in keeping with that context that we talked about, killed by his own people for committing the blasphemous act of proclaiming himself Messiah and or God?
Well,
is any Messiah before and after Jesus?
Well,
there's
no Messiah that was able to do what Jesus Christ was able to do. So there were people that made claims, messianic claims. Not only were, but there are today people who make messianic claims. But only Jesus Christ validated the claim because he had the ability to lay down his life and take up his life again, thus demonstrating that he was God in human flesh.
In the book of Isaiah, where Isaiah bespeaks a multiple appearance of Messiah, as related to book of Malachi, chapter 4, verse 5 and 6, there says Elijah will accompany Messiah. Is there any place in bespoken by Isaiah where Messiah will have multiple appearances?
No.
Bye-bye, sir. May God bless you. I am a Muslim. I converted from Christianity to Islam 7 years ago by the grace and mercy of God. My religion teaches me that Jesus Christ is a prophet of God. He is the Messiah who has come to establish the kingdom of God on earth. When he does this, where the kingdom of God is established, where all men will worship the one and only God, the God of Abraham, when this is done, then Jesus Christ will be subjected to the judgment of God. He will be subjected to the judgment of God as to the job that he did, bringing as Messiah to the entire world. And you were right, to the Gentile.
But all you're doing is making a dogmatic assertion. You're not making a defensible argument. What I was doing was making a defensible argument.
And I want to thank you, Hank, for your time and for making my decision to become Muslim, one that is the most glorious day in my life. May you have a very nice day.
No, you're just self-deluding yourself. You are self-deluded. It's as simple as that. What you are doing is you are speaking a dogmatic assertion. You're not making a defensible argument. And what I try to do is say to you that the argument does not hinge on a factor, but it is a composite portrait or picture by which only Jesus Christ can emerge. Now, in Islam, to assign partners to God is delineated as the unforgivable sin of shirk. But the problem with Islam is they're building a caricature of the relationship between Jesus Christ and the Father by misunderstanding the word begotten, by misunderstanding the biblical text. So instead, what you have given your life to is a book that does not yield authority. Rather, a book that clearly communicates factual errors and faulty ethics. Faulty ethics in the sense that a Muslim man can marry many women and beat them lightly to bring them back into obedience. And yet Muhammad had latitude for far more than the ordinary man. But in the Bible, you do not have a hierarchy in terms of gender, but complete equality. So you substituted faulty ethics for that which corresponds to reality. And then factual errors, even impinging on the deity of Jesus Christ, where you call him a prophet, where he is in fact God in human flesh, and as I said, demonstrated that he was God through the immutable fact of the resurrection. So you have a story about God making someone look like Jesus and that person being crucified in his place. The question now becomes, does what you believe correspond to reality? We'll be right back with more answers to your questions. Number to dial, 888-ASK-HANK.
In a culture that views evolution as the only rational explanation for our origins, it's more important than ever to arm yourself with the truth. In his new Creation Answer book, Hank provides the well-researched, logical answers you need to defend your faith. We'll send you the Creation Answer book in appreciation for your ministry support of any amount today. Your gift will help create more of the broadcasts that have changed your life. So please call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org now, and we'll rush you the Creation Answer book. Don't go away. Hank Hanegraaff will be back in a moment with more answers. Breaking the code of the Book of Revelation has become an international obsession. The result has been rampant misreading of Scripture, bad theology, and even bad politics and foreign policy. In the Apocalypse Code, find out what the Bible really says about the end times and why it matters today. Hank Hanegraaff argues that the key to understanding the last book of the Bible is the other 65 books of the Bible, not current events or recent history. The Apocalypse Code offers sane answers to some very controversial questions, such as, what does it mean to take the book of Revelation literally? Who are the Antichrist and the Great Whore of Babylon? And what is the real meaning of 666? Order the Apocalypse Code by Hank Hanegraaff today. Available in softcover, MP3 CD, or MP3 download from equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI.
Now more than ever, today's believer who wants to stay informed needs to subscribe to the Christian Research Journal. Here's what you'll find in the current issue of the Christian Research Journal.
The cultural phenomenon of TiVo mania has raised some interesting discussion points for Christians, such as, does public prayer before millions of viewers violate Christ's teachings in the Sermon on the Mount? Find out what we can learn from TiVo mania in the article, Prayers, Football, and Missions, Lessons from TiVo Mania. Other topics include when vague is in vogue. A new but not improved approach to homosexuality is growing among evangelicals. Chrislam, insider movements moving in the wrong direction. A fair question, does Mormon apologist Mark Schindler successfully harmonize celestial marriage with Matthew 22 verses 23 through 30?
Call CRI and start your subscription today. 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org.
Are you the product of millions of years of unguided, purposeless processes, or created in the image of a loving God? Faced with the overwhelming scorn of evolutionary proselytizers, it can be hard to articulate the truth about God's creative work, and even among faithful Christians, many misconceptions linger. That's why we want to send you a copy of Hank's Creation Answer book in appreciation for your gift of ministry support today. The Creation Answer book puts answers to the most hotly debated origins questions right at your fingertips, giving you clarity and understanding. Your gift is important, supporting more of the broadcast and resources that have changed your life. So please give today by calling 888-7000-CRI or visiting equip.org.
That's equip.org. And let us rush you your copy of the Creation Answer Book. Thank you for your partnership.
Looking for an investment with eternal significance? When you partner with us through a gift of support today, you will help multiplied millions to grow in their own faith and share it with others. There's no telling how far your impact can spread, as this letter from a listener shows. I heard Hank the first time when I was working as a farmhand. I was very curious about Christianity and had many questions. I listened to Hank each day and grew in my faith step by step. I am now a lead pastor and Christian family counselor. Thank you for everything that you have done to further me in my spiritual growth. To make your kingdom investment today, call 888-7000-CRI or give securely online at equip.org. May God bless you for helping to share the truth with the world. Now, back to the Bible Answer Man broadcast with your host, Hank Hanegraaff.
Thank you very much, Randy. And with perspective to the call I fielded just before the break, it is important to understand the difference between predictive prophecy, which is fairly straightforward, like Micah chapter 5:2, which I alluded to, and then typological prophecy, which is far more complex, and it requires some thinking. And in order to reach your Jewish or your Muslim friends, it's critical that you understand the distinction between the two, because otherwise, those who are wrapped up in a false view of reality will smugly think themselves to be on the right path. In order to disabuse themselves of that notion, you need to understand the difference. And to that end, I wrote a section of my book, Has God Spoken?, actually as an illustration in which I tell an anecdotal story so you can see through the progression of the story how everything unfolds. And therefore, this can become part of the warp and woof of who you are. But as far as specifically citing passages, as I alluded to in my comments, Isaiah 53, and for that matter, Psalm 22, are clusters of stars in the constellation of biblical prophecy that points specifically to Jesus Christ, who was pierced for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. Let's go back to the phone lines, talk to Nate, Kansas City, Missouri, listening on Bot Radio. Hi, Nate.
Hey, Hank, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Hey, I love your show. Listen to it every day on the way home from work, and I just so happened to hear the caller that came in right before I called in. And my main question is, I don't know what prophecy he was even referring to when he was talking about what passage in the Bible dealt with Jesus being killed by his own people. And I don't know, it just didn't make sense to me.
Well, again, you have a composite picture given to us in passages like Isaiah 53 and Psalm 22. The stone that the builders rejected has become the capstone. We have a composite picture of the stone, the living stone given in the Old Testament, emerging in the New Testament. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that Christians don't appeal to a text, but they appeal to a composite picture, a portrayal in the Old Testament. The portrayal is such that in the beginning, Adam and Eve fall into lives of perpetual sin, terminated by death, and then the rest of the Bible is God's unfolding plan of redemption, culminating in a new heaven and a new earth in which dwells righteousness. And in that unfolding plan, what you see is the picture of sacrifice through temple, priest. You see the lamb that is slain, And that is a portrayal of a lamb that ultimately would come and be slain so that he would satisfy the justice of God, something that we could never satisfy. So there's an unfolding picture. In the process, you have a prediction given about where Jesus Christ is going to be born. You have his lineage given in minute and specific detail. You have a composite picture or a portrayal of the fact that he would die. You have the date of his visitation and so forth. So there's a composite picture, and that composite picture is such that only one can emerge. And that's why we can say in the New Testament, Jesus fulfills that portrayal. Not because we are banking on a specific text, but a whole picture. And that is a far more deep and glorious thing to fulfill to begin with. So again, the composite picture is what is at issue.
Yeah, and I completely agree with that. I see that when I read Scripture, and that was why when that call came through, I just kind of went, what? I didn't quite understand exactly what he was trying to get at, but thank you very much. That was a fantastic answer.
Well, you got it.
All right. Well, thanks, Hank, and God bless.
You got it. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go back to the phone lines. We'll talk next to Robert in St. Louis, Missouri, listening on KSIV. Hi, Robert.
Yo, hello. How's it going, Hank? I love your show.
Thank you.
And I'm going to ask one question, and I'm going to go ahead and get off the phone because I want to hear your response. I was telling some friends in here that Mormonism is not Christianity. They seem to disagree, and I want to know your opinion of that. And I'm going to go ahead and get off the phone.
Well, Mormonism is not Christianity. Mormonism holds to a completely different view of who Jesus Christ is. They hold to a completely different view of what heaven is. They hold to a completely different soteriology. What does it take to be saved? In Mormonism, it's what you do as opposed to what Jesus Christ has done for you. And then, in Mormonism, you therefore come with good works in your hands as opposed to clinging alone to what Jesus Christ did. So the composite picture, going back to that illustration, that Mormonism presents in terms of sin and redemption is completely different than that which is given in the Bible. Now, the question becomes, what is the Mormon authority? The Mormon authority is the Book of Mormon, which they believe to be the most correct of any book on earth and the keystone to their religion. In Christianity, we say, no, it's not the Book of Mormon, it's the Bible. Now, who says that we're right and the Mormon's wrong? Well, it turns out that evidence says that we're right and the Mormons are wrong. For example, the Bible is buttressed by archaeological discoveries. So the people, places, and particulars that you find in the Bible turn out to correspond to reality. Not so with the Book of Mormon. The people, places, and particulars that you find in the Book of Mormon have been utterly discredited by both anthropology and by archaeology. So one does not correspond to reality, the other, the Bible, does correspond to reality. And this is a substantial difference as well between Mormonism and Christianity. We in Christianity say that we believe because our faith is founded in a refutable fact. The Mormon does not look at faith founded on a refutable fact, but rather they base their entire destinies on feelings. So they don't read the Book of Mormon and say, does this correspond to reality? Do the Jaredites and the Lamanites and the Nephites, are they real people groups? Is this story something that is rooted in history? No, they don't say that. They say, read the Book of Mormon and see if you have a burning in the bosom a feeling, an esoteric feeling as to whether it's right or wrong. The problem with that is feelings are notoriously unreliable. And therefore, we must take feelings and test them in the cauldron of fact, that which, again, corresponds to reality. So when I wrote my book, Has God Spoken, what did I do? Well, I looked at the manuscript evidence, I looked at archaeological evidence, looked at predictive prophecies with respect to Jesus Christ and more. And I found that all of those things correspond to reality. They're all verifiable. And therefore, you have a cumulative picture that emerges as true. The same thing cannot be said for the Muslims or, in the case of this call, for the Mormons. Let's go back to the phone lines. We'll talk next to Rick. He's listening in Oklahoma, Oklahoma, on Bot Radio. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Hank. How you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. I was very interested last week in the discussion about what happens when we die and go into the presence of the Lord. And in regard to that, I have a two-part question. Do you feel like those of the dead who have gone on in that intermediate state, do you feel like they have an awareness of a passage of time?
Perhaps. I don't know. I mean, it certainly seems as though they might. The best I can say, and I don't want to shout where the Bible's largely silent, the best I can say is that souls do have a sense of awareness. So while they don't have locational qualities, they do have a sense of awareness, and they can have a sense of fellowship and comfort in the presence of the Lord. I was spending a lot of time this morning writing a piece that revolves around Luke chapter 16, in which Lazarus dies, and he is carried by the angels to Father Abraham's side, and there he is being comforted. So he's experiencing a quality of relationship, not only with God, but also with people, those who have gone on before. So the basic idea that's being communicated is relationship, and that relationship seems to have a quality of time associated with it. But what we can say for certain is that after the transitional heaven, there will be an eternal state, and that eternal state will involve the time-space continuum, because God does not scrap things, he redeems them, such that the universe that now groans in travail will be liberated from its bondage to decay. And we ourselves will be resurrected, immortal, imperishable, incorruptible. So what happens to the universe and what happens to us physically goes hand in hand.
Well, do you think we're a trichotomy or a dichotomy, spirit, soul, and body, or just soul and body?
Well, I think that when a woman gives birth, she gives birth to a body-soul unity, which is to say she gives birth to both the physical and metaphysical aspects of humanity. However, the non-corporeal aspect of humanity, I think, has that which relates to God's created things and that which relates to the Creator, and I think the language of spirit and soul is used in that sense. That which relates to the Creator, the spirit, and that which relates to that which God created, the soul. But they're two aspects of the same non-physical aspect of humanity. Be right back.
In these tough economic times, many ministries are being forced to pull back on their outreach. You can help ensure the Bible Answer Man broadcast isn't one of them by partnering with us through a gift of any amount today. No gift is too large or too small to help keep truth on the air. Whether you can give $10 or $10,000, your generosity will be part of God's provision for this entirely listener-supported ministry, silencing the skeptics and equipping multiplied millions of Christians to defend their faith effectively and lovingly. To partner with us today, please call 888-7000-CRI or give securely online at equip.org. Thank you for helping to bless others as you've been blessed by the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Stay tuned. Hank Hanegraaff will return in a moment to answer more questions.
Now more than ever, today's believer who wants to stay informed needs to subscribe to the Christian Research Journal. Here's what you'll find in the current issue of the Christian Research Journal.
Explore how the wildly popular but violent world of the Hunger Games books and film can serve quite unexpectedly as very useful material for literary apologetics with the article Truth and Darkness, The Hunger Games as an Unexpected Resource for Apologists. Other topics include When Vague is in Vogue, a new but not improved approach to homosexuality is growing among evangelicals, birthday celebrations and Jehovah's Witnesses, the sacrament of the supper, personhood's fatal flaw, and much more. Also in the popular Ask Hank column, Hank Hanegraaff answers the question, should we search for scientific paradigms in scriptural passages?
Call CRI and start your subscription today. 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org.
Are you the product of millions of years of unguided, purposeless processes or created in the image of a loving God? Faced with the overwhelming scorn of evolutionary proselytizers, it can be hard to articulate the truth about God's creative work, and even among faithful Christians, many misconceptions linger. That's why we want to send you a copy of Hank's Creation Answer Book in appreciation for your gift of ministry support today. The Creation Answer Book puts answers to the most hotly debated origins questions right at your fingertips, giving you clarity and understanding. Your gift is important, supporting more of the broadcast and resources that have changed your life. So please give today by calling 888-7000-CRI or visiting equip.org. That's equip.org. And let us rush you your copy of the Creation Answer Book. Thank you for your partnership. Did you know that the Bible Answer Man broadcast is entirely supported by the generosity of our listeners? That means the broadcast you're listening to right now is a direct result of gifts from friends like you who have said, yes, I will help keep truth on the air. And in these tough economic times, your support is more important than ever. So if the Bible Answer Man broadcast has changed your life, please help it keep going strong with a gift of support. Every gift, large or small, has a real impact on the broadcasts that minister to you. So call 888-7000-CRI today or give securely online at equip.org. The Bible Answer Man broadcast fulfills a unique role in Christian apologetics and one our world can't afford to lose. Partner with us to make a difference today, because truth matters. The cultural phenomenon of Tebow mania has raised some interesting points of discussion for Christians, such as, does public prayer before millions of viewers violate Christ's teachings in the Sermon on the Mount? Also, does God care about football games? What can we learn from Tebow mania? The article Prayers, Football, and Missions, Lessons from Tebow Mania in the latest issue of the Christian Research Journal has the answers. Subscribe to the Christian Research Journal today at equip.org or call us at 888-7000-CRI. Once again, here's the host of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, Hank Hanegraaff.
Thank you very much, Randy. Let's go right back to our phone callers. Next up is Judy, listening in Oklahoma, Oklahoma, listening on Bot Radio. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. It was told to me to call the Bible Answer Man to get the solution to our discussion here. In Deuteronomy 24, it talks about a couple being married. The husband divorces the wife. He remarries another. And it says, like, if she dies or they divorce, he's not allowed to go back and marry the original spouse because that was an abomination to God. So is that true for today? Is that just... are we under grace that God redeems and forgives? Or, because abomination is a huge word, so...
Well, there's a historical context. And you're right in pointing that out. Divorce was widespread in the ancient Near East. And therefore, the commands given in Deuteronomy were given in order to regulate an existing practice. And in the context, remarried to her former husband would be tantamount to legal adultery, and therefore it was detestable to the Lord. But if you look at what Jesus Christ says in the Sermon on the Mount, it has said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce, but I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness causes her to become an adulteress, and anyone who marries the divorced woman commits adultery, gives you the intent of what the law was. And furthermore, Jesus Christ makes clear that what's going on is a detestable practice for the reason that men would put away women for any or every reason. In other words, they used the Levirate law, they used the laws given within the context of an ancient theocratic kingdom as the basis to do what they wanted to do. So it was tantamount to tithing your mint and your cumin, but neglecting the weightier matters of the law, justice, righteousness, and equity. And that's what really is at the heart of this, which is to say that we are not to see the other sex as an object for our own enjoyment or use some kind of legalistic prescription to do what we want, but we are to treat another person selflessly as opposed to selfishly. So there's an intent behind the law originally to protect a woman in the Old Testament, but ultimately to subscribe to that which the Bible ultimately appeals to, and that is complete ontological equality and not the abuse of another person.
Okay. So is that just, are we under grace now that that can happen? Or, you know, like if they repented, got right with the Lord, wanted to get the original family intact, are they allowed to do that or not?
Well, if in fact there is a door to reconciliation that is open, yes, we must always walk through the door of reconciliation because that is the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is reconciliation. Reconciliation always requires two parties. There's someone who is willing to forgive and someone wanting to be forgiven. And so that is the ultimate good that we should always strive towards. Now, there are some cases in which that door to reconciliation simply isn't open, and that is because someone has married someone else, and then unscrambling the egg leads to a multiplicity of problems.
Right. Yeah, I can see that. And I didn't know if it was like in the Old Testament that they didn't want wife swapping, you know, back and forth to this. But I thought, well, if a couple... excuse me, if the wife was never married again and the other marriage ended, I just didn't know if that would be an abomination to God in this day and age to consider that.
So the question becomes, you get divorced, and the question is it an abomination to get remarried?
To the original one, if that the marriage that he was in doesn't work out.
Well, again, there's a whole lot of conjecture there. I mean, there's a lot of explaining to do. Why did the marriage not work out?
Right.
You know, so there's, you know, ultimately the intent here is love and reconciliation, as opposed to using every reason possible to do something that becomes selfish instead of selfless. I mean, that's the intent. So the intent is the protection of a person. But if, in fact, let's say you can't look at a situation where a man is married to a woman, then the man gets out of that marriage and marries the original person that they were married to. That's the metaphor I was using with respect to unscrambling the egg, which you can't do. So if someone gets a divorce, that's one mistake. They get remarried. Now they're going to compound the error by getting divorced again and marrying the original person? No. You have to move on and be faithful to the commitment that you have at that point.
Okay. Well, I thought, like, you know, it said in the Bible, if that spouse dies, or if there's an adulterer.
Well, if that spouse dies, that's why I said there's a lot of explaining to do. There are a lot of converging factors that are possible. Certainly, if that spouse dies, it would not be an abomination if the Lord led you to get remarried to the original person.
Okay.
You know, in other words, if there's no obstacle in the way morally or ethically in doing that, I don't see anything that would preclude that. But I do think that that has to be done in concert with prayerful consideration before the Lord and good counseling within the context of a healthy, well-balanced church.
Right. Right. Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
You got it. Thank you so much for your call. Want to go back to the phone lines, talk to Dylan, Farmington, New Mexico, listening on KTGW. Hi, Dylan.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thank you.
My question is, why did Jewish want to kill Jesus when he was born Jewish?
Well, because Jesus Christ came and upset the apple cart. Which is to say that the people had their own traditions. They wanted to continue in their traditions. Jesus Christ came as the one who fulfilled all their traditions. So what were the traditions? Well, the tradition was temple, priest, and sacrifice. Now Jesus Christ comes and he says, I am the sacrificial lamb, and now there's no need whatsoever for a temple. Well, guess what? The temple gave the people their sociological and their spiritual identity. And now Jesus says, don't worship in a temple in Gerizim if you're a Samaritan, and don't worship in a temple in Jerusalem if you're a Jew, because the ultimate temple has come. So Jesus now says, I am Messiah, and the Jewish leaders did not want to recognize Messiah in their midst. Because what would happen? They would lose their power. They would lose their authority over the people. They would be undone. It would be over for them. That's how they looked at it. So they wanted to hold on to their prestige and their authority, their position. Jesus Christ threatened all of that. And so what did they yell out? They yelled out before Pilate, we have no king but Caesar. So rather than recognizing Jesus Christ as their rightful king, they were willing to recognize Caesar as their rightful king. Well, that's not all so different from what people do today. They want their health, they want their wealth, they want their altars, they want their churches, and they want to be at ease while the world perishes. In other words, we still want our traditions, and that's what Jesus is asking us to give up. Do you remember, Dylan, the story of the rich young ruler who came to Jesus Christ?
Sort of.
Well, you know, it was a story where the rich young ruler came to Jesus Christ and essentially asked Jesus Christ, what do I need to do to inherit the kingdom? And Jesus Christ said to the rich young ruler, go sell all your possessions and give to the poor, and then you'll have riches in heaven. Well, the rich young ruler just couldn't do that. Why? Because his possessions were more important than his relationship to God. Or think of another illustration, Dylan. There's Judas. Judas loved what was on the master's table. In other words, when he was with Jesus, he had importance, he had position, he had the acclaim of people because he was with the very man who was going throughout all the regions in the land of Israel, and he was performing miracles. And so there was a prestige associated with that. But he loved that prestige, and he liked the position, he liked the power, but he didn't really love the master. And so Jesus saw what was in Judas's heart. He saw that he wasn't there because he loved him, but he was there because he loved what he could offer him. So we face the same circumstance today. So Jesus, of course, is a Jewish Messiah. He grows up in a Jewish context. He has a Jewish mother, and he has a Jewish stepfather, and he has Jewish half-brothers and sisters. And in that context, he is asking everyone, whether it's his mother or his father, his sisters or his brothers, who do you love most? Do you love the world, or do you love the one who created the world? Well, you know, Jesus's brothers and sisters, or half-brothers and sisters, were embarrassed by everything that Jesus Christ stood for until Jesus Christ rose from the dead. And then his brother James calls himself a bondservant of Jesus Christ. He becomes the leader of the Jerusalem church, and he ends up being stoned for the notion that one of his family members is God. Only the resurrection can account for that. Then they understood that the things of this world would grow strangely dim, and only that which lasts for all eternity was what really mattered. So it's not just about race. It's not about the context in which Jesus Christ grew up in. It is about each one, whether you're a Roman at the time, whether you're Cornelius, whether you're Peter, whether you're Judas, or whether you're Dylan or Hank, we have to make the same decision today. Who are we going to serve? And if we serve Christ, it means there's a price to be paid, and we have to say, are we willing to take up our cross and daily follow him? Appreciate your call, Dylan.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
You are a smart 10-year-old. I'm looking at my board here, and it tells me you're 10 years old. So thank you for giving me a call today. I'm out of time for this edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Look forward to seeing you all right here tomorrow with more of the show.
We appreciate you tuning in to the Bible Answer Man broadcast. If you've been blessed by the broadcast and want more information to help you grow in your walk with God, just go to our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. To contact a resource consultant, call 888-7000-CRI. Again, that's 888-7000-274. Or you can write to us at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by the Christian Research Institute, a ministry supported solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters. Breaking the code of the Book of Revelation has become an international obsession. The result has been rampant misreading of Scripture, bad theology, and even bad politics and foreign policy. In the Apocalypse Code, find out what the Bible really says about the end times and why it matters today. Hank Hanegraaff argues that the key to understanding the last book of the Bible is the other 65 books of the Bible, not current events or recent history. The Apocalypse Code offers sane answers to some very controversial questions, such as, what does it mean to take the book of Revelation literally? Who are the Antichrist and the Great Whore of Babylon? And what is the real meaning of 666? Order the Apocalypse Code by Hank Hanegraaff today. Available in softcover, MP3 CD, or MP3 download from equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI. Did you know that the Bible Answer Man broadcast is entirely supported by the generosity of our listeners? That means the broadcast you're listening to right now is a direct result of gifts from friends like you who have said, yes, I will help keep truth on the air. And in these tough economic times, your support is more important than ever. So if the Bible Answer Man broadcast has changed your life, please help it keep going strong with a gift of support. Every gift, large or small, has a real impact on the broadcasts that minister to you.
So call 888-7000-CRI today or give securely online at equip.org. The Bible Answer Man broadcast fulfills a unique role in Christian apologetics and one our world can't afford to lose. Partner with us to make a difference today, because truth matters.